Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Members of the Gun Trace Task Force, an elite unit of the Baltimore City Police Department, planted evidence, stole money, sold drugs, cheated on overtime, and wreaked havoc on the already battered reputation of a police department that continues under a consent decree to try to establish credibility. My guest today is Justin Fenton, who has written a gripping, comprehensive account of the rise and fall of the GTTF, informed by his years of superb reporting for the Baltimore Sun and keen insight. He joins me to talk about We Own This City, a true story of crime, cops, and corruption. Plus, Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health on efforts to develop ways to prevent child sexual abuse. That's coming up on Midday after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. My guest today is Justin Fenton, who covers crime and police accountability for the Baltimore Sun. Under the best of circumstances, those are two distinct beats. But for the last 4 years, Fenton has been covering one of the biggest policing scandals in history, in which the criminals were cops. The Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force was started in 2007, designed as an elite plainclothes unit that would excise guns from city streets. The GTTF came to international attention when it was exposed as a criminal enterprise that thrived for years, undetected and even celebrated by the senior leadership in the BPD. The scope of their malfeasance continues to unfold, and the ramifications of it in terms of past convictions and future prosecutions are significant. In Fenton's telling in his assiduously reported book, the story is as riveting as it is horrifying. The book is called We Own This City, a true story of crime, cops, and corruption. Justin Fenton joins us today from Baltimore. Justin, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation with Justin Fenton, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So, Justin, I want to start by asking why the unit, the GTTF, was formed in the first place. Is there, or was there at the time, evidence that that kind of unit was successful? You know, other places around the country. Was it a good thing in standard practice in policing?
Yeah, I mean, the idea behind it was to have a sort of similar to a federal approach to trying to go after gun traffickers, people importing guns into the city, or alternatively, those who just had large amounts of guns and were known to be selling them on the streets. So really, at the beginning, they had them paired up with the Maryland State Police and the Baltimore County Police. I believe Anne Arundel was also part of that effort in the beginning stages. And they were supposed to sort of almost go around the state trying to figure out who was bringing guns into Baltimore City. And their work was supposed to be methodical, you know, not pulling people over and trying to get a gun at a time, but trying to take off traffickers in large amounts.
And was it successful? I mean, you write that in the very first year, they did actually get a whole bunch of guns, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this is obviously a huge challenge for law enforcement generally. It seems like there's an endless supply of guns, but to the extent that they were trying to be more focused and deliberate on high volume people, I think that in those early days, they were able to point to some successes.
Yeah, I mean, 41 arrests, I think, initially, and 268 guns. So that's a lot of guns per person. So they're going after people, as you say, that really did have a lot of guns. You also observe that these plainclothes units, so these guys in the GTTF were not dressed in police uniforms. They're plainclothes guys. And you observe that these plainclothes units have often been at the heart of a lot of police corruption around the country. So there is some evidence to suggest that abuses of these kinds of units were not uncommon.
Yeah, one of the things I was told by many people I interviewed was that these officers are often, at least in Baltimore, but elsewhere as well, are given leeway. They're told to work in a gray area, which is that, you know, they want them to be proactive. They want them to go out and find criminal activity, and in doing so, you know, there's sort of an amount of autonomy that they are given to do that, and a lot of times they're they were intertwined with the allegations of misconduct. These are officers who are going to people's houses, going to their cars, searching them on the street. They are, you know, dealing with large amounts of cash. You know, your average patrol officer, for example, is going to respond to, you know, a dispute on the street, or they're going to arrive after something has happened. Detectives, they sort of, you know, they wear their trench coats and suits and ties, and they try to piece together witness accounts and find evidence to help solve a crime. These are the units that in many cities are told, go out and stop something before it happens. Find the person who's going to commit a crime, or conversely, we believe someone has committed a crime. We want you to find the evidence that can help us tie them to that.
So given the abuses with the GTTF, and I think in other places around the country, these plainclothes units have been disbanded. They've certainly been disbanded here in Baltimore. What are we missing? I mean, as a guy who's covered policing for a long time, are we, because we're no longer utilizing this particular technique, are we missing opportunities to do just what you said, you know, cut the monster off at its head rather than, you know, react after the fact? Do you think it's hurt efforts to, you know, solve crimes and get rid of guns?
That is the major question of our time right now, to be honest. And I know that sounds pretty grand, but it really is. I mean, we are at a point where for years, you know, community relations with police have been breaking down. There's a lot of distrust in Baltimore, especially. There are fewer people who want to cooperate with these types of investigations. And so I think police, and this is sort of a chicken and egg thing, but police have turned to this more proactive, aggressive policing to try to drum up information, drum up witnesses, squeeze people, get them to flip. And in turn, they ended up pulling over a lot of people who maybe weren't doing anything wrong, who were, you know, these one of the things that I highlighted both in my Sun reporting and also in the book is these seatbelt stops. You know, the GTTF would go out into certain neighborhoods and look for people who didn't have their seatbelt on. And all of a sudden, you know, a few minutes later, they're tearing apart the car and they got the people on the sidewalk, and they might find a gun and come back to the agency and say, look what we found. And they might find five in a night, but they might have also pulled over 30 or 50 people that night. And so a lot of the distrust you see across the country, you see a lot of these traffic stops turning into deadly encounters. You see people saying, I was harassed by the police. I don't like the police. And so, you know, I think we're falling, you know, the broken windows theories of the 90s and here in the early 2000s, certainly moving away from that. The consent decree instructs officers not to do that kind of stuff. But, you know, there is some pushback in other corners saying, well, you know, if you are waiting for shootings to happen, if you're investigating them after the fact, and we have a poor track record with investigations here, you know, how, you know, it seems like there's going to be, you know, an increase in crime, and we have seen an increase since 2015. So it's like, I think we're trying to find that sweet spot. And for some people, it's defunding the police. In other respects, it's beefing up, you know, detective work. And I think we're absolutely in the throes of that. We don't know where that's going to shake out. I think Commissioner Harrison was just on Meet the Press over the weekend saying that he thought that we need to rethink traffic stops. And there's a lot of studies and reports out there about the low effective rate of these traffic stops. But, you know, you ask veteran police, and this is the bread and butter. It's you know, pulling over a car for a taillight out and finding out the person has a warrant for their arrest, or they're a fugitive, or seeing drugs, or seeing a gun. And this is how they get at that stuff. And so it's like, we're at a real, I don't want to say tipping point, but we're in an interesting moment of trying to reevaluate that kind of stuff and figure out, well, what can we do instead?
Justin Fenton, his new book is called We Own This City, A True Story of Crime, Cops, and Corruption. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. We're talking about the book. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email's midday@wipr.org, and you can tweet us, of course, at @midday WIPR. So, Justin, tomorrow is the 6th anniversary of the uprising that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray back in 2015. And the scandal that is the Gun Trace Task Force the subject of your book, really unfolds in this period. It was started in 2007, but the indictments came, I guess, in 2017. Is that right?
Yes.
And so between the uprising and when the indictments were handed down, a lot of stuff came down. The leaders of this, a guy named Wayne Jenkins and other people, committed a whole lot of crimes. Talk about the importance of it happening in this context, as you just mentioned, of the severe increase in crime that Baltimore City experienced following the death of Freddie Gray and the violence that incurred.
Yeah, one of the things that I was happy to be able to do with the book was really lay out how these things all sort of overlapped and intertwined. It actually starts back in 2003. I start with the career of Wayne Jenkins. He joins the department during zero tolerance as they shift, and he's making a lot of arrests as they wanted at that time. And then as the strategy shift towards, you know, sort of more targeted violent repeat offenders, as they would call it, you know, he's part of those squads. And then, you know, he's right there in the middle of the uprising at Mondawmin Mall. He's helping to, you know, save an injured officer. And you know, that's sort of what is remarkable about this scandal, is that it came at a time when the police department was desperately trying to show that it could reform itself, that, you know, the federal government was going to come in and do this, you know, they were going to scrutinize the agency, they were going to do ride-alongs, they were going to be looking around every corner and trying to find, you know, how this agency wasn't serving the public. And these officers in that climate, in that context, are not, you know, scared about this at all. They are in many respects stepping up their misconduct because of the way, I guess, the agency is formatted, the way it operated. They were not afraid of being detected. And so for that to come out, I think that there's a line in the book that said it just laid waste to their credibility, that the trial of the two officers who you know, wanted to go to trial, you know, you put all these officers on the witness stand, and they're outlining just years of stuff and how they did not fear repercussions. And so it was a real wake-up call about how, you know, not necessarily how bad, you know, officers in Baltimore are, but how bad they can be if they want to be, and the things that can occur if people, you know, are sort of emboldened and not checked.
Yeah, I happen to have that quote in front of me. It had laid waste to what remained of the Baltimore Police Department's credibility. This wasn't a one-off disputed incident or a case of one bad apple. The public had heard from the officers themselves, who had come together in this elite, well-regarded unit, admitting to an array of pervasive misbehavior, unobstructed for years by any systems designed to stop them. And that's the thing. This happened right under the noses of senior command, and they apparently didn't understand or didn't know, didn't even have an inkling of it. I mean, is that your conclusion after all of the reporting that you've done? That, I mean, is there any complicity that you, any evidence of complicity or, you know, purposely turning a blind eye on behalf of, you know, the Kevin Davises of the world, who was the commissioner for part of this, and there were other commissioners as well. What's your ultimate conclusion about senior leadership?
Yeah, I mean, as far as direct complicity, I mean, there's no evidence of that. There's no evidence that they sort of knew they were committing crimes and you know, stealing money and drugs. And I think that makes sense in the context of, you know, if you're going to do stuff like that, you want as few people to know as possible. And I think certainly the officers who flipped, I think that's exactly what the feds wanted. They wanted to take this up the chain, and we haven't had anybody above the rank of sergeant charged or implicated. However, you know, I think there's strong evidence that the agency just really was not interested in accountability. And there's you know, it's a very complicated situation, as I try to lay out. There's reasons why victims themselves might not come forward. There's, you know, but one of the things that was most striking to me was the way that commanders talked about how, on the operations side, that is, the people who direct where the resources go, how to respond to hot spots, and how to combat crime, just really had no relationship with the internal affairs side. You know, they viewed that as, you know, you do your thing, and if you find something, let us know. And in the meantime, we're going to keep trotting these guys out here because we need them. You know, we need them in the fight. And even when I think internal affairs did find credible cases, and there were. I mean, there's a host of cases. It's not as though it was completely unreported. Yeah, I think that there was this sense of like, well, you know, come on, you know, we don't believe that guy, do we? And I'm not going to take this guy off the street for that reason. You know, some of these officers were very anonymous to me. I had not heard of them, frankly. And then you have officers like Daniel Herschel, who was absolutely in the news for years. In 2006, the Sun had reported that he had dozens of complaints against him and that a judge had sort of called him out. In 2014, the Sun's Undue Force series by Mark Puente, they got a lot of attention. He was spotlighted in that article as one of a handful of officers with repeated misconduct lawsuits against him and settlements. And even the rapper Young Moose had called him out on his recordings, and there's been coverage of that. So, I mean, this idea that sort of it was unknown, that's not true. But the idea that they didn't look hard enough, they didn't maybe want to look hard enough, that's certainly an indictment of leadership there.
And Wayne Jenkins himself, who was the ringleader. I mean, the sentences that were meted out for these guys, you know, range from 7 years to 25 years. And Jenkins is the one that's been sentenced to 25 years. He's currently serving that term. But he had numerous complaints and civil lawsuits and even criminal charges. But he got away with everything every time. I mean, he was never really held to account. So I want to talk about that when we come back from a break. Justin Fenton, the book is called We Own This City: A True Story of Crime, Cops, and Corruption. We'll have more with Justin Fenton on the other side of a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. To follow me, it's @TomHallWIPR. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Hala Vinsay.
In the coming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll be sharing 5 advantages of health savings accounts and also some key findings from a new report on the rapidly evolving workplace. You can find the Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life podcast on WIPR's website and mobile app, wherever you get your podcasts, and at transamericainstitute.org.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a new film will soon be broadcast on PBS about Abraham Joshua Heschel, an influential rabbi who was a close colleague of Martin Luther King Jr. during the civil rights movement of the 1960s. The Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch and Benjamin Sachs of the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies are featured in the film. We'll talk with them about Heschel's significance and legacy tomorrow here on Midday. Plus, we'll check in with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Letitia Geraza. And coming up a little later today, a conversation with a researcher at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health about protecting children from sexual abuse during the pandemic. Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau will join me in just a bit, but now we return to our conversation with Justin Fenton, an investigative reporter with the Baltimore Sun, whose new book chronicles the rise and fall of the Gun Trace Task Force, which started as an elite unit of the Baltimore Police Department, ended up being an enormous criminal enterprise. The book is called We Own This City: A True Story of Cops and Crime and Corruption. To join our conversation, 410-662-8780, midday@wipr.org is our email address, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. So, Justin, I think one of the things you do that was really revelatory and helpful to me, as a person who had read the stuff you'd written about this in the Sun and I've read another book about this by Baynard Woods and Brandon Soderberg called I Got a Monster, came out about 7 or 8 months ago, is you try to understand how Wayne Jenkins came to do what he did. You mentioned that he trained with 2 officers who had a history of unlawful searches and lying, and that just before he joined the force, a previous commissioner, Ed Norris, who's now a talk show host, was indicted for various misuse of a police foundation account. And then not too long after that, another commissioner, Kevin Clark, was fired by then Mayor Martin O'Malley because of allegations of domestic violence. What's your ultimate conclusion about Jenkins and the reason he went to such the extent that he did? Is it just greed, or how do you understand the reasons for his behavior?
Yeah, honestly, I'm still trying to figure out where exactly things went off the rails. I think what we see, though, is him coming up in a dysfunctional agency, him getting some early questions about his conduct in which he's not held accountable, where, again, as I spoke earlier about sort of the two different silos in the agency not talking to each other, you know, he's having, you know, civil lawsuits that are going to court or questions raised in federal court. And it doesn't seem like anybody from the agency is paying attention to that. It really is happening in a vacuum. And without any repercussions, I think that has to create an environment where you feel as though you can get away with stuff. You know, one of the things I tried to track was like how people viewed him. He was viewed as someone with like sort of an innate ability to spot, you know, guns. You know, people would tell me stories about riding in a car with him, and he all of a sudden sees something out of the corner of his eye and turns the car into a U-turn and stops the person. Sure enough, there's a gun on them. And even people who didn't know about the crimes he was committing spoke about how he was viewed. And you see it in his emails. I did a public records request for his emails. And every day he made sure to promote himself and talk about the work that his squad was doing. And you see the emails back, I think more instructively, from supervisors saying, wow, you know, you are such an asset for us. I wish we could, you know, clone you. You know, I want you to teach other people how to do what you do. And also, you know, there's one case where he did come very close to getting in trouble. There was some real credible evidence of him planting evidence, and the case kind of got far along in the queue, and he eventually gets cleared. He basically, it's a moment where he should have sort of breathed a sigh of relief and gone about his business, maybe changed his ways. but instead he sends he's given an option of sort of, you know, sending a letter back, you know, sort of, do you want to make a statement now that you've been cleared? And he just excoriates the internal affairs detective who investigated him and said, you know, that should never happen to anyone ever again. So you see that this dual thing where he's getting the results they want, and he's also making sure that everybody knows how great he is and how nobody should mess with him if you know any complaints do come up.
And the title of the book comes from a friend of Jenkins, a guy named Donald Stepp, who testified that you know, police officers in Baltimore, quote, owned the city. What do you think of that assessment? I mean, now that you've, you know, learned as much as you've learned about this unit, about how it went undetected, and about what's going on now, do you think they're right?
I was definitely struck by how sort of not afraid a lot of these officers were, and how the systems were not in place to stop them in a way that they felt like they were going to be detected. I would like to think that's changing with body cameras. I feel like this all did happen sort of pre-body cameras. Body cameras were just coming online at that time. I think at the time of the indictments only, in the period where the crimes were the worst, I think two of the officers had body cameras, only two, and then a couple more came online. And other, you know, some, I'm sure people would say that they would have found a way around that too. But I think that would help. But I mean, yeah, it really showed that officers who wanted to do this, the system is set up so that it's going to be hard to rein it in. There's one court hearing I covered where, you know, the judge finds that the officers made an unconstitutional stop. And instead of that turning into a big headache for them and then being taken off the streets, she ends up, you know, thanking them for the job they're doing. Because again, this is 2015, crime is up. The police department is sort of reeling in the sense that they're being asked to get crime down. And so that, you know, people found themselves sort of apologizing to them, saying, I'm really sorry for criticizing you in this moment, but, you know, just do a better job next time. And, you know, that sort of stuff is not a good way to rein in bad behavior.
We have a caller on the line from Baltimore, Brian. Brian, welcome to Midday with Justin Fenton.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me. Hey, Justin. Real quick, so Justin, I wanted to get your thoughts, and Tom, yours too, if you have any, around the firing of Assistant State's Attorney Anna Mantega and the apparent revelation, or at least the belief that she leaked information of the investigation to Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, and whether it was done intentionally or inadvertently, does that seem to have represented some kind of professional, you know, misjudgment or malpractice even you know, just that her blind spots, apparently, from what the public knowledge is, were so huge that she had no thought that he was potentially implicated in the investigation and that what she may be doing may compromise that investigation. What are your thoughts on that? Thank you.
Great question, yeah, Brian. Justin, what do you think?
That's a real complicated situation where there's a lot of blame to go around. Just to wrap it up, or to summarize it real briefly, in the early days after the officers were arrested, it was said by the federal prosecutors at the detention hearings that they believed that someone in the state's attorney's office had leaked toward the investigation to Jenkins, that they tipped him off. And that set a lot of tongues wagging in town. There was many defense attorneys on social media and things like that saying, who's the leak? We need to know who the leak is. Well, it turned out the federal prosecutors overstated what they knew at that point. I think that they went a little further than the information that was available to them, and it really turned out that there probably wasn't a leak at all. But that turned out to land at the feet of a prosecutor named Anna Mantegna, and amid all this public pressure to identify the leak, she was fired. And it turns out she wasn't a leak. There was really no way for her to know anything about the investigation. The way they framed it was that, you know, she had tipped off Jenkins to something else, that one of his officers was, you know, he'd done something in front of a judge that he shouldn't have. And her response to that is that she felt, you know, a responsibility to tell him, hey, you got a questionable officer in your squad. And so that's being litigated. There's a lawsuit filed over that. It's been refiled. And but new information came out just, you know, recently as a result of the investigation into the Mosbys, because they're now using that episode to show that the federal prosecutors investigating them for possible tax crimes, you know, have something against them. And it's, you know, because of this whole episode with this prosecutor. So it's a lot to unpack there, but that's my read on it.
Yeah, no, it's true. And the prosecutor is Leo Wise. And it's the folks who are defending the Mosbys and say that they're being unfairly targeted in a federal investigation that their own attorney has characterized as a criminal tax investigation. They're saying mm-hmm. that this is somehow retribution by Leo Wise against them because of this leak that happened in the GTTF case. He also figures into the case of Detective Sean Souter. And I want to ask you about that. There have been commissions put together to study what happened with Detective Souter. He died under mysterious circumstances. Ultimately, the official word is that it was a suicide. But you write that he had reached out to his attorney. This is Detective Souter, a guy named Jeremy Eldridge, after meeting with the FBI, and that there was some evidence that Detective Souter was concerned about a possible indictment. The lawyer says, no way. I mean, what's your ultimate conclusion about how Detective Souter died and, you know, what happened in that part of this very complicated story?
Yeah, I mean, that actually remains an open homicide, but the suicide theory has taken root with the police department. It remains an open case, and it's currently being there's some additional work being done on it. I mean, I don't come to a conclusion on that. I think that there's a lot of information I try to lay out, including some new information. Talking to Gary Childs, the retired Baltimore City and Baltimore County homicide detective who led an independent board that was set up to try to look into it. But there's just so much. There's so much that I think is open to interpretation. And I also quote, you know, Detective Souter's attorney and his family, and David Fowler, the former medical examiner who's under a lot of fire right now for the Derek Chauvin trial. But you know, there's just you know, it's. I think that it's going to remain a mystery. Hopefully my book helps at least lay out some of the different information that's out there, and people can form their own opinions.
I knew Gary Childs back in the early 80s. We were neighbors. And I can simply say that I know Gary to be a straight-up guy, a guy of great integrity, a former Baltimore City police officer who lost his dear friend and partner in the middle of a drug raid back in the 80s, Marcellus Ward. I happen to know that personally that Gary's a guy I think whose integrity is unquestioned for what it's worth. Patricia Jessamy, who was the state's attorney, held the position that Marilyn Mosby now holds, started a do not call list of these officers that she suspected were not going to be credible and didn't want them testifying in the trials that her office was prosecuting. Greg Bernstein, who succeeded her, evidently gets rid of this list. This is according to your reporting. And now there's another list. I mean, Marilyn Mosby does have a list. The ramifications of this extend much further than just the people who are involved with GTTF, but there's a whole list of people in the Baltimore Police Department that the state's attorney's office doesn't think they can call credibly to testify in trials. That's a huge problem, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think just to go back to the first point, I mean, I think that Mrs. Jessamy was really ahead of her time on that. As far as I could tell, she may have been the first prosecutor, you know, that I could find who had done such a thing. And she felt that it was necessary because the police department, in her view, was not doing enough she did not want to use these officers. And the only way to curb the police department's use was to say, if you bring a case with these guys, I'm dropping it. I do not want cases brought with these people. And I mean, if you recall at the time, the police commissioners were furious. I mean, that was a big reason. You know, Fred Bielfeld went out on a limb and you know, publicly supported Greg Bernstein because they didn't see eye to eye. And the tone at that point was work more with police. You know, stop. I think the slogan for Greg Bernstein was fight crime, not cops, or something along those lines. And it's amazing the sea change that has occurred in just a few years. You know, and I tracked that in the book. You know, when Marilyn Mosby ran for office, it was a tough on crime campaign. She said the police are doing their jobs. It's the prosecutors who aren't doing their jobs. And in the point between when she got elected in June of 2014 and the time that she took office in January 2015, we are in the throes of the Black Lives Matter movement. There are cases coming out, you know, every month, every week. There's protests across the city where people are demanding more accountability. And she too shifts into a, you know, where she's talking more about justice and police accountability. So, it's amazing. When I first started on the beat, it seemed like all politicians wanted the FOP's endorsement. You know, they were putting cops in their campaign ads, and we would write about whether that was appropriate or not. And now it's like, you know, the FOP is, while politicians are in some cases are still accepting money, it's kind of the scarlet letter to have their support. And it's just a tremendous shift.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's the Fraternal Order of Police. I think it's a really acute observation. Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina, is now in negotiations with Cory Booker, senator from New Jersey, and Karen Bass, a congresswoman who is behind the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. And they're talking about this bill. And one of the sticking points is whether or not individual officers can be held accountable, or should it be the departments, the police agencies, that should be held accountable? And Senator Scott is saying that if we perhaps allow departments to be held liable, that is a solution to having more accountability among individual officers. And of course, Andre Davis, a former solicitor here in Baltimore, argued that very argument and lost when it came to the city being held liable for damages for the actions of people on this gun trace task force. What do you think is going to happen with that moving forward? I mean, is it going to be a matter of, and of course, we've just had the General Assembly repealing the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. So there's a lot of police accountability legislation happening at various levels of government. But where do you think that's headed in terms of financial culpability and liability among police?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting issue. I mean, I think that for the longest time, the police department has indemnified officers. They cover the bill, basically, when they are sued and there's a large judgment, because the argument was, you know, no one would want to become a police officer if they do the wrong thing, you know, mistakenly or otherwise, and they end up having to pay a multi-million-dollar judgment. Just no one would want to even bother. So the city said, we will pick up the tab if something comes up like that. But at the same time, it's also abundantly clear that sort of nothing really, you know, more needs to happen. The officers really do not feel the effects of that. They are, you know, while they aren't, it doesn't hit their wallet, it's also not hitting them in a, or hasn't in the past, I should say, at least, hit them in an even in
administrative way. they stay on the job. They're you know, we don't hear about discipline. If there is discipline, it's you know, it might be a couple days suspension or something like that. So it's an interesting idea, but you know, I'm not sure. So you referenced the Court of Appeals ruling with the GTTF, and that was a pretty significant ruling in the sense that it said, you know, the city made the argument that this stuff was so bad that we shouldn't have to pay for it. Like, we did not want them to do this stuff. When they did it, they were acting outside the scope of their duties. So they should be responsible for that. And in the past, the courts have really, you know, found that yes, if it goes outside the bounds, it's not something to be paid for. But what they found in that case was, you know, these guys are doing the job. You know, they're wearing your uniform. They're out there with a gun you gave them. They have a badge you gave them. And if they do stuff while in the course of doing their jobs, you are liable for it because you didn't do enough to rein them in. And so, you know, they put the burden more on the city in that respect. And you would hope that leads to more accountability, but that remains to be seen.
Yeah, it does indeed. It's a complicated and interesting issue. Justin Fenton covers criminal justice for the Baltimore Sun. The book is called We Own This City, A True Story of Crime, Cops, and Corruption. A production team headed by David Simon, himself a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun, is currently working on an HBO series based on Justin's book, which is expected to hit the airwaves on HBO in the fall. Justin, congratulations on the book. I'm glad that an HBO audience will be able to be added to the audience of folks who are reading the book. But it's really, really well done. So thanks for your time. Okay. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And coming up next, Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau joins me with the latest on research about children who've been made more vulnerable to sexual abuse because of the pandemic. But before we go to a break, each week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 96 people have been victims of homicide in Baltimore. City police have released the identity of two people whose homicides were first reported the week before last. They are Edward Johnson, age 31, and Sherry Smith. She was 68 years old. Seven people were victims of homicide last week. They are Davon Mason, age 32. Quentin Bryce, age 36, Antoine Oglesby, age 43, Ivan Green, age 38, Rudolph Smith, age 48, Rodney Williams, age 56, and Nikea Jackson. She was 27 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're tuned to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.